This is the start of the October 16th, 1986 interview with Grady Levins, owner of Levins Seafood of Apalachicola, Florida. The interview is done in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project, and the interviewer is David Taylor of the Bureau of Florida Folklife Programs. Okay, we're rolling. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you to tell me, when you were born?
August the 18th, 1943.
And where was that?
Pensacola, Florida.
What kind of work did your dad do?
My father was working at one of the local Navy bases over there and retired from over there also. But we moved to Milton when I was quite young. I was born in Pensacola and raised in Milton, Florida, in Bagdad, Florida.
How did you happen to move over this way?
Well, I went to work in a supermarket when I was 13 years old and very independent, you know, young man, kid. So I decided I'd make enough money to move out on my own and did, and moved into an apartment and walked to school every morning, caught the bus back to my job in the afternoon, stayed there for 6 years. And then I went to work with American Signament Company over in Pace, Florida, the Fibers Division, where they were making good continuous acrylic yarn, which was supposed to duplicated silk. It didn't fly, you know. So they had a reduction in personnel and moved me to Panama City, Florida, to Arizona Chemical Research and Development Laboratory. And my ex-family was involved in the oystering business then, and I started moonlighting on the weekends and I was, you know, pay scale then was for a laboratory technician was pretty good, but I could make more money Saturday and Sunday fishing for oysters than I could in 5 days working in the laboratory. So I said, well, you know, I think what I'll do is just buy a boat, tongs, motor, and everything and just start doing this for a living. Well, I commuted back and forth from Panama City to Apalachicola for 2 years, and I just got tired of the drive. And started looking around for a place to lease with the option to buy, which is the same location. It was just a very, very small place. And in fact, I'm supposed to have a couple of pictures here somewhere of it. And to show you the way we really got started off, and so you can see what we've built in 14 years. But that's the original Levins Seafood Inc. right there.
Yeah.
Okay, the little tin building, shucking house. This was the only cooler that I had right there, which was out in front of the kind of side of the building.
Uh-huh.
And that was my office there, you know, just...
This little metal building.
Right.
Wow.
What's so funny about that? I mean, when I did put it together and set it on the platform, I couldn't get in it without really bending over. But I was sharp enough to figure that out. I just got me some 2x10s and nailed them up straight and set the building on top of 2x10. So then I could get my office, you know.
Well, let's go back a minute and talk about how you learned about oystering in the first place.
Well, I started coming down with my ex-brother-in-law. And on Saturday and or Sunday, or both days, and he could tong and cull oysters. That's quite an art to doing this. And I think oyster fishermen are born, they're not made, really. You have to have the aptitude and have the skills to do it. And I, according to him, I caught on pretty fast. And it was always a challenge for me as a fisherman then to outdo my fellow fisherman, be faster than he or better or, you know, more efficient and things like that. So I did master the skill of culling oysters. And I never tonged any oysters until I quit my job with Arizona Chemical. So, but then here I was out there that day, and the wind was blowing real hard out of the east, and the current was running the opposite direction, and the boat lay sideways, and it took everything in the world I could do to stand on that boat. But I had a partner with me, and that. We harvested 40 bushels of oysters the first day I ever tonged oysters in my life. But after a month, I caught on to it. But one thing about it, though, when I worked in the laboratory and started to harvest oysters, I was 38 through the chest, and within a year, I was 44.
Wow.
So it's real healthy work. And I'd wake up at night, and my hands and arms would be completely numb. And I really, it was a different experience. I knew then how one felt that didn't have any arms, because, I mean, I'd have to get out of bed, massage my arms to get circulation going again, because that's a lot of physical strain, but it's good, healthy work.
What's involved in culling? What do you have to know to do that?
Well, there's when the tonger, the tonging the oysters, put the oysters up there, you quickly glance at them, and while you're working on one, there may be two oysters together or baby oyster. You have to tap that apart and put the baby back in the water and save the harvestable size oyster. Maybe there's a large shell, but before you pick that oyster up, you've got to know what you're going to do to it before you do. And there was for a 60-pound bushel of oysters is what we harvested then, still getting now, and real, real good oysters. I could cull a bushel in 3 minutes. So, you know, I've caught as many as, and that was the best conditions. But two men on the boat and real good oysters then, which they're not like that here anymore, as overfishing, storms, various different things like that. If you average 7 bushels an hour, you were doing pretty good. And have harvested as many as 12 bushels an hour. So.
Are you culling them according to size, too?
Yes. There is a culling law for all states, especially the state of Florida, and that is the oyster's greater dimensions has to be 3 inches with a 15% tolerance. Then there's no tolerance right now because we're trying to recuperate from a storm. And then we caught mostly single oysters, where if there were clusters, all clustered up, you had to know exactly how to pick that oyster up to make them just shatter like glass, you know, as far as coming apart out of a cluster. And a lot of times you pick up a cluster with 6 legal size oysters in there. And if you knew just how to tap it with a culling tool, every one of them would just fall apart, you know, and then you could put them right on in the container.
Sort of like a diamond cutter, I guess.
Yes, really.
Now, what did a person to use tongs, what do you have to know?
Well, that is an art within itself also, because, you know, tongs are similar to post hole diggers. You know, now a post hole digger, you stick straight down and pull apart to, you know, to remove the earth or dig a hole. Now with tongs, you put them gently on the bottom and kind of rake the oysters together. If you really put a lot of pressure, then you're going to get gravel, mud, and everything. And then if you get a lot of mud, then the tonger, when he puts it up for the man to cull, then they can't see what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then if they're real scattered oysters, you can gently walk your tongs from the back to the front, or from the front to the back of the boat, working only one side and raking the oysters along until you get them all collected up, and then go ahead and get them in your tongs and bring them up and put them on the boat.
Are the two tongs joined in any way?
Yes, there's a pin through handles to where they you can kind of rake and a pivot point, and all of it's very important because and you use different length tongs, or the length tong that you use is determined by the depth of the water. And I kept 2 to 3 sets of tongs on my boat at all time, because you never know when you're going to break a set. If you only have one set of tongs, and you know it's run back in and lost my day's work.
What lengths would you keep?
I kept 12 foot lengths, 14 and 16.
Mm-hmm. What is it about the boats, that the oyster skiffs that people use around here, that makes them good work boats for oysters?
Well, they have to be they need to be at least 8 feet wide. And that's across the bottom, give you 9.5 feet across the top, 25, 26 feet long. And that way, in choppy weather, you've got a good, stable boat. And then they build a walk area all the way around the edge of the boat, with the exception of the stern. So you actually stand on top of the boat and not down in the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you do your tonging from.
I see some of the boats have kind of a platform in the stern there, sort of built out. Are those oyster boats too? They seem to protrude a little bit.
Yes, yes, they do. And I think primarily the main reason for that is to, in high seas, to keep the boat from sinking, because I've sunk two boats.
Yeah.
Okay. One of them was very, very bad weather. And what happened, I was up on the boat working, and with the seas, the stern would dip under and gradually take on water. Now, this platform protruded out, you know, makes it ride where it doesn't start dipping and taking on water over the stern board.
Do the particular parts of the boat, the oyster skiffs, that is, have names? Like the, I noticed that some of them have kind of petitions inside. Do those have any...
Yes, you have, naturally your bow area, which is most of the time a storage area for life preservers, rope, anchor, things like that. And then the mid part of the boat is, they call it the hole, because that's where the oysters are stored. And it's right in the center of the boat to where you equally distribute your weight so that in the event that you do have quite a few oysters on there, you do not sink it. And then the back area is a cabin area, and you've seen, I'm sure, most of them have cabins on them, and that's when it, you know, when it's raining, for if a thunderstorm comes up or something, the people can get inside out of the weather and stay dry until the rain's over.
So how long were you at Oyster before you decided to get into a business of your own?
Well, I'd always been in business from the very first day that I went to Oyster. And it was wholesale distributorship, just a sack horses. My first marketing area was the state of Alabama, and very, very heavy in Dothan, Alabama area. But as our business started to grow, and I stayed in the Bay for at least 5 years while we were here, and the business kept growing and growing, and my wife, Alice, decided that we were just depending on other trucks to come in and buy product from us, which was not a very good business practice. So we decided that we'd buy a truck and go to the customers. And she started our very first route system herself. In fact, I never forget, she had a black Electra 223, 1973 Buick, you know. And in order to show samples, we took the back seat of that Buick out and put bag oysters in it. Put gallons of oysters in an ice chest in the trunk, and she went over to Panama City, Fort Walton, and Destin, you know, drumming up business. So, and realized that there was potential there. So, I took a day off out of the bay. We went to Bainbridge, Georgia, and bought a international truck with a 18-foot refrigerated body on it. And she would, I would load it the night before, and leave the refrigeration unit running or plugged in or something to a power supply. I would leave daylight going to work in the bay. She would leave daylight to go run a route system right by herself, driving this big truck, unloading bags of oysters and gallons and things.
Who are your customers? What sorts of people? Were
The restaurant trade mostly. And then we had we sold to wholesale distributors also.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously to have a business like that, you have to have the product to sell. How does a person in a place like this where looks like there have been seafood companies for a long time attract fishermen whose oysters and fish that you buy?
That was one of our biggest problems, because we were, you know, no one knew us here, okay? So therefore, fishermen were skeptical of us. I oyster fished myself, and then maybe I had one other fisherman only, and you know, that's not enough to support a business. So Alice got to know Blake Thomason here, and we'd moved here about the same time, and he was bringing oysters in from the state of Louisiana. So she would take that black Electra 223 Buick out to his establishment and get 4 or 5 sacks of Louisiana oysters and bring them down here for the shucks to shuck, and then she'd go back and get more, you know, because this all she could carry at one time. And recognize the fact that we could not necessarily depend on the product out of the bay or the fishermen, because they didn't know us. We just had to make arrangements to start bringing in oysters from the other states, which primarily was the state of Louisiana then.
Mm-hmm. In other places in the East Coast, especially up in New England where I'm from, I'm very familiar with the lobster fishery up there and the influence of the fish dealers. And over the years, many of them, particularly in the smaller areas, sort of have informal arrangements with the fishermen where they buy their fish or lobster or whatever, and in turn they give them credit when they're not fishing and lend them money oftentimes for boat and gear. Do arrangements like that happen between dealers and fishermen around here?
Oh, yes. I guess it's a common practice throughout these United States because recognizing the fact that productivity was not that great in Apalachicola Bay, I decided that I would look at Escambia Bay over in Pensacola area. And 2 months prior to September 1, there appeared to be a great deal of oysters over there. So I loaned fishermen money and, you know, paid their rent to move over there and all kind of things. And we got over there, and in 2 months' time, all the product died. So, you know, I lost a great deal of money there in just a few days.
Do fishermen, oystermen usually stay with one dealer, or do they sell wherever they want to sell? How's that work?
They pretty much stay with one dealer, and it's either because they think he can sell the product better than the next one can, or the other friendly competitor can, or like him. You know, there's a dozen different reasons why. And I've got one fisherman that's been with me for 10 years, I guess. And I have an oyster shucker in there that's been with me, I guess, probably 12 years. And he's in his 70s, but he got old enough that he could no longer go in the bay to fish oysters or harvest oysters, so he wanted to come in and shuck. Now, the guy doesn't need the money. I mean, you know, he's done well for himself. He's worked hard, but he has to work to live. You know, if he quit, he wouldn't last probably 2 months, but I really, really respect him because he's very dependable. He gets in here early in the morning. He's one of the last people to leave, and, you know, I contribute a lot of our success to him and to everyone like him that's been with us for so long, you know.
What are the usual activities here at the Seafood Company on a day when oystermen are oystering? What's the first thing that happens in the morning and go through the day when they through the process?
Well, early in the morning, we open 6:30, 7 o'clock, and this is now before daylight, but you have your oyster fishermen bringing their fuel tanks down and getting empty sacks and with their lunch pails and little cooler with Cokes or something, refreshments. And just as soon as it gets light enough for them to start crossing the bay, you hear the motors start cranking up all around Franklin County, you know, and hear the buzz of outboard motors crossing the bay to get out early in the morning to before it gets too warm to start harvesting oysters. And then later in the afternoon, it's in the reverse. The oyster fishermen are coming back in, the buzz of the outboard motors going through the Department of Natural Resources checking station to make sure the product's legal and they have the right number of sacks and things like that. But in the interim, right here, as the boats are leaving, you know, the noise level starts picking up in the shucking room in there because all the ladies are chattering about what happened the night before and getting ready to go to work, putting their aprons on, you know, putting their hair restraints on and getting their gloves on and picking up their hammers and start pounding away at the oysters to get them shucked. And this goes on all day long, you know, until later on in the evening as the boats are coming in. And a lot of times you'll have it where the oysterman goes out and brings his wife here to shuck oysters. And then when he comes in, she's finishing her day of shucking so they can go home and get dinner and, you know, get a good night's rest and start it all over again the next day.
You mentioned the fisherman's wife also working for you. Is that common for in a family for the husband and the wife to work for the same outfit?
Oh, yes, it's very common, yes. And in a lot of cases, what you have now is that if the wife does not stay here and shuck, she'll go out on the bay with the husband just to cull oysters for him, and they can make pretty good money. And as he's tong and she's culling, and then if he gets the board, culling board piled up with oysters, then he'll sit down and help her cull all the oysters off, and then he'll, you know, go start the routine all over again, start tonging until he gets, decked up is what they call it, you know. Mm-hmm. Then help her cull again.
Do they usually make just one trip out and back every day, or do they come in various times to unload?
There's been one time in my history here to where one husband and wife team made two trips in a day's time, and their boat would only safely carry 50 bushels of oysters. They caught 100 bushels that day. And this was a couple of summers ago when, you know, we really had a lot of oysters out there. And those people made some money that week now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the fisherman, he's heading back now in the late afternoon, and he brings his boat up to the dock. What happens after that?
Well, when he brings his boat up to the dock, he sits his bushels of oysters out on the dock. And I have a man down on the dock to put them on a pallet. And then from that area... we bring them up, and we don't shuck too many Apalachicola oysters because they're so popular for half shell, especially when production is so low right now. So they go up to our washing area, and we dump them through our washing machine and put them in boxes, and then they're go into the cooler or directly on a truck to be distributed either to the state of Florida, or Alabama, or Mississippi, Georgia, Tennessee, North, South Carolina, and we even air freight some to Colorado, Aspen, Colorado, during when there's snow skiing, and we have air freighted some to Puerto Rico and on to California.
Is the washing machine that cylindrical drum that you showed us outside?
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Then what happens with those that aren't sold in the shop? What happens to them?
In our washing area there, we do a certain amount of grading. If they're too large for half shell consumption, then we put them in a large metal bin. They're stored in the cooler overnight because ordinarily your washing takes place later in the evening after the shucking is over with. And they're stored in the cooler, and then they come into the shucking room to be shucked for the large ones, which is fine because most of your restaurants don't like small oysters, just the oyster meat for frying and stuff like that. They like a nice-sized, meaty oyster. And they're shucked, then they go into our receiving area and packing area, and the shuckers are paid at per gallon. It's like piecework. And they're measured in the receiving area and then stored into containers. All right. From there, they go into what we call a blower or washer. This has a positive air pressure through the bottom through dispersion tubes, and it's very chill. We keep the water temperature 33, 35 degrees, and it removes shell particles, grit, stuff like that, and increases shelf life. And before I started using this positive air washer, I bought a lot of teeth. I don't buy nearly as many teeth now as I used to.
What do you mean, people sue you and stuff?
Yes, well, they filed insurance claims, and I think we bought, since January, probably half a dozen teeth this year.
Huh.
But they bite into an oyster that has a shell on it and break it, chip a tooth or something, and then, you know, they go to the dentist and then file claims against my insurance company then.
Well, I'm surprised people would go to that trouble.
Well, believe me, they do.
I suppose that's a problem that confronts anyone that deals in food sales.
Well, I had a letter in from one corporate chain of restaurants that we sell to here about 2 months ago. Said a lady bit down on an oyster shell and broke her left front foot. I mean, really, that's just the way it was worded in the letter. It was a typo, but nevertheless, it was there.
You've got whiplash.
Yeah.
You explained to us very well about the shucking equipment and the financial arrangements between you and the shuckers. Could you go over that once again, about the fact of the shuckers being contractors?
Yes, that's really a problem. I really don't have any control over the hours that they work. Okay, so I open up this establishment at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning for them. I provide them with a position to work at. And they, if they elect not to come to work that particular day, they don't call. I mean, they just don't come. And but then the advantages that that I have, if I feel like a shucker is jeopardizing, say, a position in there, or mistreating a position, then I'll ask her to go somewhere else and find a place somewhere else to work, because we provide very good conditions for them. We try to provide them very nice oysters to shuck, and we try to make sure that they can work more here than they can any other place. So these are my advantages, you know. But even though I don't have any control over them, I cannot tell them when to come to work or when to leave or anything about it. You know, I do have those options to exercise. And right now we're trying to get a ruling on it, because we have to, you know, hold out everything, all the withholdings, and I just don't feel like that we should have to do that, because they are kind of contract labor, and we're trying to get a ruling on it from IRS now. And you know, if they rule in our favor, then we'll discontinue all the withholdings. Now, workman's comp will always have to be held, because that's for our, theirs and my protection. But the rest of it, I won't be doing that anymore.
How does a shucker get a job with you? If I were to come down here tomorrow with my boots and apron and knife and bonnet for my hat, for my head, could I get a job?
Well, it would depend. I mean, we have some portable positions that we have not put back in there because production hadn't been all that great. But if I have an available position where there's no one working there, true. It would be no problem just to go to work. But then this lady feels like that is, even though she may not necessarily come to work that day, that position belongs to her, and you better not fool with it, you know. But if there's any openings, and I probably would have some right now, because when you really get an influx of shuckers coming in is when these oysters get really plumpy fat, and they can shuck 5 gallons an hour, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 gallons an hour. Right now, you know, they're shucking maybe a gallon, gallon and a half, 2 gallons an hour, something like that. And they're not really interested in working that much right now. But, say, in the when they do get fed, I have them standing in line outside. They're trying to get in and get a place to work. And then calling the people that they know that has a position there and ask them if they're going to work tomorrow. Because if they're not going to work, they want to come down here and work in their position that particular day.
Talk about positions, do you mean a particular stall?
Yeah, that's right. That's right, because every one of these ladies have their own stall. They have their own footstool that they stand on, and, you know, that they have their own favorite stainless steel bucket that they shuck into, and their knife and hammer and gloves, they bring that, and apron, you know, they bring that to work with them every day. But then I've seen times when I'd almost have to certainly not get between two ladies with hammers, but I've seen them almost go at each other with hammers in there.
Over what?
Well, one accused the other of getting a better oyster than she was getting, you know, especially, I mean, everybody's making good money. God, they were shucking 4 or 5 gallons an hour, you know, and then all of a sudden they'll fight over the last oyster that we're going to shuck in a day's time.
Apart from just being familiar with your work area, is there any advantage over one stall to another?
According to my shuckers, yes, there is. They don't like to be at either end of that table in there because of the conveyor. They say, well, if they're on one end or another, then someone else is going to beat them to the best oysters. Are they going to, you know, I have actually seen some of these shucker ladies take smaller oysters and throw them back over into the belt, too, on the conveyor. Mm-hmm. But I could see where the very end position to one on either side might be a disadvantage, because some of them may open their little windows and get the better oysters out before they get to the end, and, you know, and leave a few shell that may be in a sack or something that go into the very end.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Well, we've got a few more minutes. I'm going to have to change the tape in just a couple minutes. I noticed that there were a few young men working out there, too. Is there a particular name to describe their positions
You mean as shuckers or just?
Well, there were a lot of shuckers, and then there were other fellows doing other things. Is there any name for their position?
Yes, they're called housemen.
Oh, yeah.
That's a local colloquial term, I guess, they use here. But then, you know, we have for a small place, quite a few employees, and their jobs are to just make sure that everything runs along in a day's time, and they're, you know, if they're on the outside washing oysters, then one of them they alternate, keep everybody doing different jobs so that one doesn't get bored with one thing, or maybe one particular job may be a little harder than the other one, and everyone has his fair share of it, of that one particular time. But then they dump the oysters into the washer, and that's one job. And then as they're coming out of the washing tube there, I have a man there to make sure they're spread out on the conveyor belt. And while he's spreading them, he may remove shell particles and throw them out. Then I have another man that are throwing the oysters that are too large out into the metal bin to be shucked. Then I have another man that may be picking a certain size oyster that's a specialty type oyster, you know. And then I have another man sitting in a sitting position that's doing the weighing, and there's a trap door involved there to where, when for whatever weight it is, when the scale balances, he can close the door, and the oysters keeps on coming to keep him from shutting the operation down. And then from there, that man sits it on a plastic crate. Another man throws a little bit of